Good morning and welcome to the Friday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Times the Brief is supported by Squarespace, providing tools for creative individuals and business owners to make a website. Squarespace includes hosting, e-commerce, and 24/7 customer care. Learn more at squarespace.com/thebrief. On Friday, a group of French officials boarded a 12-hour flight to Paris from Réunion, a volcanic island and French territory in the southwest Indian Ocean. With them was a 9-foot-by-3-foot piece of flotsam many believe is a wing flap from Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, which vanished en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing on March 8, 2014, with 239 people on board. It was the unremarkable final stretch on what may turn out to be the wing flap's remarkable journey, if indeed it is a wing flap, and if it turns out to have actually come from MH370. Sources in Boeing have told CNN they are confident the flotsam was part of a Boeing 777, and experts have little doubt the part came from the doomed jetliner. That would mean this debris could have been drifting on ocean currents for more than 500 days for some 2,500 miles, or the equivalent of driving Route 66 from New York to Los Angeles. Yet what is more remarkable is what more it can tell us. It could, for example, nix ongoing search efforts, which are currently focused around 1,000 miles off the coast of Perth in Western Australia. Authorities have scoured 21,000 square miles of a 23,000 square mile search zone in an operation costing well over $100 million and which has involved thousands of flights, dozens of ships, and several submarines. They are now poised to head south and double the search zone's size. On Friday, Australian Deputy Prime Minister Warren Truss told a press conference that he was confident this zone was the right one based on continuing refinement of the satellite data. He added, "We will continue to concentrate on the southern end of that identified area." However, according to Eric Van Sabeel, a lecturer in oceanography at Imperial College London, the flotsam's very appearance in Réunion, if it is proved to come from MH370, would mean that searchers have been looking in the wrong place. If you take into account the currents in the Indian Ocean, then you can trace the flow backwards from the northern part of the search zone, he tells Time. It would exclude the southern part, as anything that drifts from there would go eastward into the Pacific Ocean. Following the discovery of the supposed debris, spotted on a pebble beach by an eagle-eye government worker named Johnny Begu, helicopters have been scouring Réunion, which lies about 600 miles east of Madagascar, for more. Reports of luggage fragments are currently being investigated. However, Van Sabeel also believes such efforts are largely misplaced, factoring in the frenzied nature of the ocean's currents. The ocean currents are not like highways. They are not really simple and predictable. They are actually quite chaotic. It's a bit like the weather, he says. It's just like how San Francisco is typically used to the westerly wind, but every so often it might come the other way. It's the same for the ocean. Experiments with GPS-tracked objects released 30 feet apart in the ocean have resulted in them drifting hundreds of miles apart within just a month. So while the broad strokes of the ocean's currents can be mapped, conclusions are typically ambiguous. By tracing the currents from Réunion back to the search zone, our best hope is that we can perhaps pin down the region to perhaps a few hundred miles, which will still be very large, says Van Sabeel. The barnacles clinging to the wing flap can also tell a story. Very quickly, investigators will be able to tell from their size how long the object has been in the water, meaning that even if serial numbers cannot categorically prove the object came from MH370, identifying the plane model combined with time adrift could remove reasonable doubt. As there are more than 1,000 species of barnacles in the ocean, with their provenance depending on myriad environmental factors, Benny K.K. Chan, associate professor of marine biology at National Taiwan University, says that it would also be possible to lead back to a specific crash site by identifying certain varieties. There are some species of barnacles that have very distinct distribution, and so if you get some of these, then maybe you could get some hint from where this wing flap has drifted, he tells Time. But from the pictures, I can see only the Lepus genus, which are common to nearly all floating objects. Experts are due to examine the flotsam at a laboratory in Toulouse, with conclusions expected in the next day or so. But the value of the wing flap, again, if MH370's wing flap is what it actually is, increases exponentially should more debris be found, especially and perhaps surprisingly if it is found far from the original discovery. If we find some debris somewhere else on a completely different part of the Indian Ocean, then what we can do is backtrack that too and then look at the overlap, says Van Sabeel. You can then look at the overlap of all the rough areas. It's essentially triangulation. This article posted by Charlie Campbell.
Zimbabwe's wildlife minister says extradition is being sought for the American dentist who killed a lion. Opa Munchiguri, Environment, Water and Climate Minister, told a news conference Friday, "We want him tried in Zimbabwe because he violated our laws. Police should take the first step to approach the prosecutor general, who will approach the Americans. The processes have already started. Unfortunately, it was too late to apprehend the foreign poacher as he had already absconded to his country of origin," Munchiguri said. "We are appealing to the responsible authorities for his extradition to Zimbabwe so that he can be made accountable." On Tuesday, American hunter Walter James Palmer issued a statement saying he relied on his guides to ensure the hunt was legal. Written by the Associated Press.
Mullah Akhtar Mohammed Mansour has been chosen as the head of the Afghan Taliban, according to two commanders of the Islamic militant organization. The commanders said the longtime deputy of the deceased Mullah Omar was elected at a shura, or meeting of top Taliban representatives, just outside the Pakistani city of Quetta, where many of them are based, Reuters reports. Siraj Haqqani, who leads the Haqqani militant faction within the Taliban, has been selected as Mansour's deputy. Mansour is only the Taliban's second-ever leader, with Omar having been at the helm since founding the Afghanistan-based militant organization in the 1990s. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid confirmed reports of Omar's death, although he said it occurred more recently than April 2013, the date given by the Afghanistan government earlier this week. For some time, Omar has been suffering a kind of sickness, and over the last 2 weeks it became more serious, and due to that illness he passed away, Mujahid said. The Taliban founder has not been seen in public since 2001, leading to widespread speculation of his whereabouts and multiple reports of his death over the last decade. Peace talks between the Taliban and the current Afghanistan government, due to be held in and mediated by neighboring Pakistan, have been postponed indefinitely in the meantime. Pakistan cited the reports of Omar's death as the reason for delaying the talks, because of concerns that a battle for succession could further deepen discord between the Taliban's numerous factions. This article posted by Rishi Iyengar.
Russia's state media watchdog is investigating whether gay-themed emojis on Facebook are in violation of Russian laws against promoting homosexuality. The probe initiated this week comes as the result of a complaint from Mikhail Markchenko, a senator in Russia's upper house of parliament, who was the first official to note the potential danger in the cartoon smiley faces of boys kissing boys and girls kissing girls. In his written appeal to the Federal Service for Supervisions of Communication, Information Technology, and Mass Media, which is known in Russia as Roshkomnadzor, the senator from the region of Bryansk called for an investigation into whether the emojis violate Russia's controversial 2013 law against homosexual propaganda among minors. These emojis of non-traditional sexual orientation are seen by all users of the social network, a large portion of whom are minors, said the senator. But propaganda of homosexuality is banned under the laws and under the pillars of tradition that exist here in our country. In response to the senator's complaint, the federal agency asked the main youth group of President Vladimir Putin's political party, the Young Guard, to form an expert opinion on the matter of high social significance, according to Izvestia Daily, which obtained a copy of the agency's response to the senator on Wednesday. In the response, which was written by the deputy head of Roskomnadzor, Maxim Sentsov, the agency said it is prepared to take reactive measures against the emojis if they are found to constitute a threat to Russian children. Under Russian law, the agency is able to block Russians from accessing websites that are found promoting homosexuality among minors. It can also impose fines against those websites for failing to comply with the legislation. Denis Davyov, the chairman of the Coordinating Council of Young Guard, which is the youth wing of Putin's United Russia Party, said that his organization would ask professional psychologists to determine whether there is propaganda in these emojis. Written by Simon Schuster.
Suspected Jewish assailants attacked a Palestinian village in the West Bank early Friday and torched two homes, killing a young child and critically wounding at least three people, Israeli and Palestinian officials said. The Israeli Prime Minister called the incident a terror attack. According to the military, the suspects entered the village of Duma near the city of Nablus, where they set the homes ablaze and scrawled graffiti, including "Long Live the Messiah," "Revenge," and "Price Tag." The attackers threw Molotov cocktails or firebombs at the houses, the military said. The slain child was identified as 1.5-year-old Ali Dabwatsheh. His 4-year-old brother and parents were among the wounded, according to a Palestinian official. He said Jewish settlers broke the window of a house and flung a burning object inside, causing a quick and huge fire. He added that three people were wounded aside from the child. The Israeli military said three people were critically wounded and one was slightly injured. The critically wounded were taken to Israeli hospitals for treatment, the military said. Settlers in the Nablus area are very aggressive. They never stop attacking Palestinians in their villages, and the Israeli government needs to put an end to these aggressions, he said. The Israeli military said it sent troop reinforcements to the West Bank, fearing the incident could trigger unrest. Jewish extremists have for years attacked Palestinian property as well as mosques, churches, and even Israeli military bases in opposition to what they see as the Israeli government's favorable policies toward the Palestinians, although it is rare for anyone to be killed in such attacks. Critics say police have been slow to apprehend the assailants, and Palestinians say the military has failed to protect them from attacks by militant Jewish settlers in the West Bank. The attacks, known as Price Tag, have been condemned across the Israeli political spectrum, and condemnations came swiftly Friday, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu issuing a stern statement against the violence. "I am shocked over this reprehensible and horrific act. This is an act of terrorism in every respect. The State of Israel takes a strong line against terrorism, regardless of who the perpetrators are," he said. Israeli military spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner called the incident nothing short of a barbaric act of terrorism. Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon said Israel would not allow Jewish terrorists to carry out such acts. "We will not allow Jewish terrorists to harm the lives of Palestinians in Judea and Samaria," he said in a statement, referring to the West Bank by its biblical name. "We will fight against them firmly and with all means and tools at our disposal." Meanwhile, Israeli police said they would restrict entrance to Friday prayers at a Jerusalem mosque to male worshippers over the age of 50. Police said the decision was not necessarily related to the West Bank incident and comes as police received word that Palestinian youth at the mosque planned to cause disturbances. This article posted by Mohammed Daragma and Aref Tufaha for the Associated Press in Duma, West Bank. Daragma reported from Ramallah. Associated Press writer Tia Goldenberg contributed to this report from Tel Aviv, Israel.
Egypt has completed construction of a multi-billion dollar expansion of the Suez Canal that the government says will boost the country's economy and aid world trade. The expansion was a massive project completed in just 1 year after it was initially projected to take 3. It adds 35 kilometers of new channels, in addition to 37 kilometers of existing waterways that were dredged to allow larger ships to pass. According to the Suez Canal Authority, 258 million cubic meters of earth were removed from the desert to cut the new channels. The development will allow more ships to pass through the canal on a given day, reducing wait times for one of the world's most important shipping channels. The government expects that the project, along with increases in world trade, will increase the daily number of ships from 49 at present to 97 a day by 2023. The project's total cost is more than $8 billion, but the government claims it will more than double the annual revenue generated by the canal, which is currently around $3 billion. The canal was completed in 1869, and it allowed ships to get from Europe to South Asia without sailing around Africa. Control of it was considered so important that Britain, France, and Israel tried to wrest it away from Egypt in 1956. For Egypt's military-backed government, the completion of the project at lightning speed offers a chance to project an image of competence, prosperity, and stability after years of unrest following the 2011 uprising that unseated President Hosni Mubarak. The new portions of the canal are set to be inaugurated next week in an elaborate ceremony, in which the government is expected to tout the new canal as a glorious achievement. The task of portraying Egypt as stable takes on a particular urgency, since the Egyptian state is fighting an ongoing battle against insurgents based in the Sinai Peninsula. An upsurge in attacks began in July 2013 after Egypt's armed forces deposed Islamic President Mohamed Morsi, who had been elected a year earlier. Since June, militants have assassinated Egypt's chief prosecutor, attacked military positions, and launched a missile at a naval vessel in the Mediterranean. If they're able to carry it out without any compromising security incidents, they're also going to use this as an opportunity to project a different image of Egypt, an image of Egypt as stable, able to carry out major public works, and defend competency against these jihadi enemies, said Michael Hanna, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation in New York. The government's message was clear on the banks of the canal on Wednesday, where officials had installed a billboard saying, "Welcome to Safe Egypt and its Secure Canal." At a news conference in the city of Ismailia, Suez Canal Authority Chairman Vice Admiral Mohab Mambish repeatedly used the word safe. "The whole world uses the Suez Canal. The world and the shipping lines are partners. We are sending the messages. We want to again assure everybody that the Suez Canal is very safe and secure," he said. "The government is dealing with the whole thing in a very propagandist manner," said Amir Adli, a non-resident scholar at the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. The way the project was launched was to indicate that the new military-backed regime can do something, and they have proven their capacity to do something. Adli said that due to a lack of transparency, it was difficult to assess the potential economic impact of the expanded canal. "There is definitely a political element in it," he says. "It has the potential, of course. There is a good chance that it will increase the revenue. But the way it is being dealt with, we don't have enough information." Written by Jared Maslin.
Times the Brief is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code THEBRIEF at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Build it beautiful. Chung Mong-joon, a 63-year-old South Korean billionaire who has a controlling stake in car company Hyundai, says he will throw his hat into the race to replace Sepp Blatter as FIFA's president. Blatter, who served five terms as president of the embattled global soccer governing body, will be replaced in an election slated for February 26, 2016, CNN reports. Chung has told various news outlets that he will formally announce his candidacy by next week. He's up against some pretty well-known names already, according to CNN, including French former soccer star Michel Platini and Brazilian footballer Arthur Antunes Coimbra, popularly known as Zico, who have both confirmed their intentions to run. Chung does have some football chops, though. He is a former FIFA vice president and also the president of the Korea Football Association, the KFA. Under his 17-year stewardship, the KFA increased its budget from $3 million to $100 million, CNN reports. So far, he has pledged to turn scandal-ridden FIFA around. "It's not easy, but people don't want to be part of corruption. They want to be part of the solution," he told Reuters. "We cannot leave FIFA in this kind of disgrace." This article posted by Joanna Plusinska. Police in India have arrested two airline employees in connection with what is suspected to be a human trafficking operation centered on smuggling female victims of the Nepal earthquake to Gulf countries, the AFP news agency reports. The two ground staff members working for the national carrier Air India were arrested earlier this month after police at New Delhi's International Airport found seven Nepalese women heading to Dubai who had their travel documents stamped despite not having cleared immigration controls. Under questioning, the airline employees said they had been paid to furnish forged documents for the seven women. In a subsequent raid on a local hotel, police found an additional 21 women who will now be returned to Nepal along with the seven stopped at the airport on July 21st. Human trafficking has been a major problem in the region since before the April quake, with some 10,000 to 15,000 people from Nepal, most of them women and children, trafficked every year for manual and sex work, according to the UN. According to AFP, the women found in New Delhi had been smuggled into India via bus from areas in Nepal that had been devastated by the earthquake that shook the region in April, killing thousands across the poor Himalayan nation and also affecting parts of eastern India and China. The traffickers had apparently taken them on a circuitous route in the western Indian state of Gujarat before flying them to the Indian capital, all in a bid to evade immigration controls. It wasn't clear what fate awaited the women in the Gulf countries where the traffickers had attempted to send them. This article posted by Sanya Faruqi in New Delhi. The final choice for the host city of the 2022 Winter Olympics was uninspiring. One candidate, Beijing, which co-bid with the lesser-known Chinese city of Shangxi-Kao, spent months trying to convince International Olympic Committee delegates that its famously bad air, not to mention lack of natural snow, shouldn't scupper its chances. The other contender, Almaty, boasts lots of powdery stuff because of its positioning at the foothills of the Shan Shan Range. Almaty's slogan, perhaps aimed at Beijing and its man-made snow, was "keeping it real." But Kazakhstan's former capital had to overcome a serious obstacle, its obscurity, especially compared with a Chinese city of more than 20 million people. The two candidates shared other weaknesses. Neither has much in the way of global winter wonderland appeal, and both are tainted by the authoritarian governments that lead them. In recent months, China's President Xi Jinping, who just hours before the Olympic decision appeared in a video pitching Beijing 2022, has presided over a crackdown on civil society in which hundreds of people, such as lawyers, writers, and women's rights activists, have been detained. Kazakhstan's president claimed a 98% victory in this year's polls, but the long-serving leader has a habit of muzzling the media and jailing his opponents. On July 31st, at a secret vote by around 85 IOC members in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, the 2022 Winter Olympics was awarded to the odds-makers' favorite, Beijing. After all, the Chinese capital had successfully hosted the 2008 Summer Olympics. No one doubts China's ability to build needed infrastructure within 7 years. "There can only be one winner," said IOC President Thomas Bach in a razzle-dazzle ceremony complete with soaring music. Xi, in his video campaign, had already projected that Beijing 2022, the 24th Winter Olympics, would be fantastic, extraordinary, and excellent. The KL polling was marred by technical doubts in which the initial vote by electronic tablet was considered possibly lacking in integrity, forcing IOC members to vote again by written ballots. Previous IOC ballots, including one in which Beijing lost to Sydney by 2 votes for the right to host the 2000 Summer Games, were marred by vote-buying scandals. The IOC vowed to root out corruption within its ranks. Late last year, the powerful group also unveiled reforms designed to limit the budget overruns that have plagued recent host cities. The IOC was left with Beijing and Almaty by default after cities such as Oslo and Stockholm pulled themselves out of the race because of financial concerns. Olympics may bring global prestige, but they have a habit of saddling host cities with huge bills and sporting facilities that rust away after the crowds disperse. The 2014 Sochi Olympics, for instance, cost Russia an estimated $50 billion. For 2022, Beijing and Almaty gave estimates of $3.5 billion, including some infrastructure not specifically for the Games. But Olympic cities rarely stick to their budgets. Sochi overspent by $36 billion. Earlier this week, the U.S. Olympic Committee pulled the plug on Boston's bid to host the 2024 Summer Games after local opposition to the potential financial burden. In the run-up to the July 31st victory, Beijing brought out Chinese icons like towering basketball legend Yao Ming to promise that the Games would be athlete-centered. Other former Olympians gave assurances about Beijing's air, which city officials had said improved by around 15% in the first half months of 2015 compared to the same period last year. "We will improve the air quality not only for the Games but also for the demand of our people," promised a pairs figure skating gold medalist, according to Chinese state newswire Xinhua. "No matter whether we will win the bid or not, we will take efforts to improve the air quality." Chinese Olympic officials vowed that snowmaking efforts would be sustainable in a chronically parched region. To speed the journey to the ski slopes, which are around 200 kilometers from downtown Beijing, city planners have promised to build a high-speed rail system that will transport athletes in less than an hour, a third of the time it now takes. In other countries, such a project might seem overwhelming, but this is a country that has already expanded its national rail network in record time. Beijing's 2022 bid slogan was translated in English as "Joyful Rendezvous Upon Pure Ice and Snow." It sounds better in Mandarin. President Xi has enthused about the potential for winter sports development in his homeland. Just imagine 1.3 billion lugers, biathletes, and curlers, if Xi's estimate of future winter sports enthusiasts is to be believed. Still, sports are not integrated into daily life in China as they are in, say, Brazil or even India. Shangxin Kao, where Olympic snowboarding, biathlon, and certain skiing events will take place, has developed resorts for aspiring Beijing skiers, but it was traditionally better known for fur production. The Beijing 2008 Olympics were expertly choreographed and allowed China to proclaim its rising superpower status. China won 51 gold medals, more than any other country. The medal haul was all the more impressive given that China won just 5 gold medals 2 decades before in Seoul. But the Beijing Olympics suffered from a fun deficit. Compared to other games, there were fewer public venues where locals could gather to watch the competition on TV and rejoice in China's sporting glory. Some residents resorted to peering through a metal fence at the venues. Even today, despite efforts by the government to encourage nationwide fitness, school sports remain underfunded for children who aren't being cultivated as potential Olympians. Chinese kids need to spend more time cramming for tests. The fact that China has already hosted an Olympics and made history may explain why the domestic reaction to the 2022 race was relatively muted. On Friday morning, a corruption investigation of a retired People's Liberation Army general generated more cyberspace comment than the Winter Olympics vote. International human rights campaigners, however, used the occasion to highlight human rights violations in both candidate nations. Whether China or Kazakhstan wins the honor of hosting the 2022 Winter Games, the IOC will face an extreme test of its new commitment to improve human rights protections, said Minky Warden, Global Initiatives Director at Human Rights Watch, before the final vote. The International Olympic Committee should insist that the host country rigorously comply with the Olympic Charter and basic human rights, or risk losing the right to host the Games. At least Beijing is a known quantity, even if co-host Shang Zhikao is less recognized. Shang Zhikao progressively lost shared billing with the Chinese capital as the bid progressed. Any guesses where the 2018 Winter Olympics will be held? That would be Pyeongchang, South Korea. Not exactly a world-famous winter retreat like Innsbruck, the 1964 Games, Sapporo, 1972, or Vancouver, 2010. This article posted by Hannah Beach. The science of why you crave comfort food. It's not just because these foods are tasty, it's because they make us feel less alone. By Alexandra Sifferlin. In mid-July, I was visiting my hometown in Minnesota when I happened upon the unmistakable scent of something deep-fried. I was at a concert, and no matter how off-brand a dietary choice of corn dogs and cheese curds may be for a health writer, I went for it. How could I not? I spent two thoroughly enjoyable summers during college working at the Minnesota State Fair, and that experience continues to make corn and grease-dipped hot dogs not only appetizing, but somehow irresistible, too. Summer is the season for nostalgic eating. Hot days in the park call for a trip to the ice cream truck. Concerts call for corn dogs. Baseball games call for hot dogs and beer. Ice-cold movie theaters call for popcorn. And it's not just me. Researchers suggest that when we associated foods with happy memories, the effects are profound, impacting how good we think foods taste as well as how good those foods make us feel. It makes intuitive sense that positive experiences with a given food could influence our craving for it later on, but recent research also suggests something else is at play, too. Comfort foods remind us of our social ties, which means they may help us feel less lonesome when we feel isolated. In a recent July 2015 study, Jordan Troisi, an assistant professor of psychology at Sewanee, the University of the South, and his colleagues found that people with strong relationships preferred the taste of comfort food when they experienced feelings of social isolation. Comfort food seems to be something people associate very significantly with close relationships, says Troisi. This probably comes about by individuals coming to associate a particular food item with members of their family, social gatherings, and people taking care of them, which is why we see a lot of comfort foods that are traditional meals or things had at a party. Of course, what counts as comfort food is different person to person. When Troisi has asked people to write about an experience they've had with a comfort food, essays have ranged from soup to kimchi. It's not just that ice cream, for instance, is really tasty. It's that someone has developed a really significant meaning behind the idea of ice cream due to their relationships with others, and that's what is triggering this effect, he says. Even the smell of a meaningful dish can elicit feelings of belonging, some research suggests. In a February 2015 study, Virginia Commonwealth University researcher Chelsea Reed and her colleagues had 160 people smell 12 different scents, including apple pie, cotton candy, and baby powder, and rate the extent to which the scent was familiar, arousing, autobiographically relevant, and the extent to which it elicited nostalgia. Nostalgia can be evoked in different ways, but scents may be particularly likely to evoke nostalgia due to the strong link between scents and memory. The smell of pumpkin pie might bring all those holidays with family flooding back, or the smell of a familiar perfume might arouse memories with your partner, says Reed. Biologically speaking, scent and memory are closely tied. Psychological research has demonstrated that smells are powerfully linked to memory and to autobiographical memory in particular, says Reed. The olfactory bulb, which is involved in the sense of smell, is linked to areas in the brain associated with memory and emotional experiences. Humans have a fundamental need to belong, says Reed, and because nostalgia often centers around personal events involving people they care about, she sees the evocation of nostalgia as one way people can obtain a sense of belonging even when the people they are close to are not close by. So, while corn dogs in the summer may not be fine dining by any standard, for me they trigger happy memories of summers long ago, and that's a good thing, in moderation, of course. Mark Zuckerberg announced that Facebook's solar-powered internet plane, Akiya, has taken flight. In a video posted to his Facebook page, Zuckerberg introduced the 140-foot wingspan aircraft that is designed to provide internet access to remote regions. It already has over 20,000 likes. Akiya is a solar-powered unmanned plane that beams down internet connectivity from the sky, he wrote. It has the wingspan of a Boeing 737, but weighs less than a car and can stay in the air for months at a time. This effort is important because 10% of the world's population lives in areas without existing internet infrastructure. To affordably connect everyone, we need to build completely new technologies. Per Recode, the plane isn't just an idea or a mock-up. An actual version of the plane was built in the United Kingdom, and Facebook plans to test it, probably somewhere in the United States, later this year, according to Facebook's VP of Engineering. This article posted by Benjamin Snyder for Fortune. 1,000 musicians appear to have learned how to play the Foo Fighters song Learn to Fly together in an effort to inspire Dave Grohl to come and play in Cesena, Italy. The website Rockin' 1000 claims the group has not been to Romagna since 1997. These diehard fans had to raise 44,000 euros in a crowdfunding campaign to pull off the stunt. Now it is just a question of whether the Foo Fighters or Dave Grohl will see the video and post on social media that he will be there or not. This article posted by Olivia B. Waxman. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.